Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today, looking for a high of 109. We topped out at 110 yesterday. 107 is average for today. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-80s. More of the same for tomorrow. Sunny and 110, 111 on the way for Thursday. Right now, with relative humidity of 11%, it's 103 degrees at KJZZ. Arizona third graders will soon learn if they are moving on to the next grade. As KJZZ's Catherine Fritke reports, fewer than 1,400 students did not meet the mandatory standard.
Of all the state's third graders that took the AZ Merit Test, about 2% of those students failed the mandatory Move On When Reading standard needed to jump to the next grade. But Alexis Burkhart with the Arizona Department of Education says that number will likely drop because of different exemptions like special education students and English language learners.
There were just about 87,000 students that tested, and this is 1,384 that did test into this Move On and Reading. The exceptions are not taken into account.
Burkhart says they were pleased with the 51% reduction in failing tests compared to last year. Catherine Fricke, KJZZ News.
With less than a week until the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, there appears to be signs of trouble within Arizona's GOP delegation. They've been told by state party leaders to vote for Donald Trump as nominee or risk losing their credentials to attend. That's angered some members of the Arizona anti-Trump movement. Peoria's Lori Hack is a Ted Cruz supporter who withdrew her pledge to vote for Trump on, quote, God-given principles. Hack was removed as a delegate by State Party Chairman Robert Graham, but she vows to show up in Cleveland anyway.
He does not have the authority to tell me that I am no longer a delegate for Cleveland. So I am headed for Cleveland on Saturday, and I will be there to pick up my credentials at the appropriate time.
Hack says she opposes Trump's candidacy because she believes he's a liberal Democrat. Prominent Republicans, such as the state's two U.S. senators, John McCain and Jeff Flake, as well as Secretary of State Michelle Reagan and Attorney General Mark Brnovich, will not attend next week's convention. There are in this country upwards of 14,000 police departments. Those agencies come in different sizes and have different resources. But what if that number was lower? Alex Weiss thinks it could be. He has a consulting firm in Chicago that works with state and local law enforcement agencies. He's also an adjunct professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University, where he's part of the program on consolidated and shared services in law enforcement. And Alex, what kind of consolidation do you think should be happening?
Well, in that context, one has to think about kind of where we begin. And where we begin is with a highly fragmented law enforcement system with around 16,000 state, county, and local law enforcement agencies. That's consistent with our kind of political notions of local control, and in many places it works just fine. In others, however, what you see are a couple problems. One is a duplication of services. So what's happened is over time, in a number of different places, communities have tried to address those problems. So, and there's about four different ways to do it. One is through regionalization, where small agencies combine, sometimes under some kind of intergovernmental agreement, to form a new agency. In other places, you have new communities that kind of merge their police departments. We have quite a bit of contracting going on now, where a community, sometimes a relatively large, will decide that the cost of providing their own services are too high. So they'll contract with, in many cases, the local sheriff. And then finally, we just have what I would call kind of sharing services.
Do you find that these types of things tend to happen in smaller communities? I mean, do you find like large metropolitan areas will have a larger police force?
Well, it depends on the region. For example, in the Phoenix area where you are, there are several large suburban police departments, most of which are quite well-staffed and well-trained and have great capacity. In other areas, for example, in Baltimore, they have a city police department and a county police department that provides much of the police service for all those small communities outside the city. But it really kind of runs the gamut.
With everything that's been going on with law enforcement and some of the controversies surrounding law enforcement, training has really become an issue that a lot of people are talking about. And I'm wondering, when you have mergers or consolidations or any of these other kinds of arrangements, what happens to the consistency and the quality of the training?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think one of the things you see in this fragmented system is that what we get is a very fragmented approach to training and policy. They have a lot of small agencies. They often have to rely on some regional or state-level organization for training. So that's good. I mean, it's a kind of an efficient way to look at it. But then they come back to the agency, and the agency may have its own field training officer program. It probably has its own policies. It certainly has its own mission and values. So one of the disadvantages that we have in this fragmented system is that a small agency may really lack the capacity to do its own training and its own policy development. Larger agencies have that capacity. Now, I should say that being bigger is not necessarily the answer. I mean, some of the most egregious problems we've seen are in the largest agencies. So simply getting bigger doesn't answer that.
Do you find, though, that in some of the larger agencies, be they large municipal police departments or some of these maybe more regional ones, that the more officers you have, the harder it is sort of to get consistency, just the bigger and bigger you get? You have more people, more personalities, more ways of doing things, that the uniformity becomes more of a challenge.
You're absolutely right. It is really a challenge. A consultant I knew a number of years ago used to argue that once an agency gets above 1,000 sworn officers, they're essentially unmanageable. And there's an element of truth to that. I think it's very, very difficult. These large agencies, once you get into the 8 or 9 or 10,000 size, what you have to have is extraordinarily competent systems to oversee this.
That's Alex Weiss. He's an adjunct professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University, where he's part of the program on consolidation and shared services in law enforcement. But not everyone thinks consolidation is the answer. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with a professor in ASU's School of Criminology and Criminal Justice, who says our law enforcement system was developed purposefully to be fragmented.
Charles Katz is a professor of criminology and the director of the ASU Center for Violence Prevention and Community Safety. He says there are around 18,000 police agencies in the country, including local departments, state, federal, and special districts like parks and transportation systems. And he understands there are many benefits to consolidation, especially of smaller police departments. But he says that's not where the majority of the problems are happening.
Keep in mind that 50% of police agencies, local law enforcement agencies in the United States, have 10 or fewer sworn officers. So the typical police agency is very small, 1 to 9 officers. The police agency that has 500, 600, 1,000, 2,000 officers is the rarity. And so when people talk about consolidation, it can take on a variety of forms, but perhaps where it's needed most is where it's least likely to take place given geographic size and resources that are available.
Right. So consolidating some of these small rural maybe departments would be the more useful thing, but that's not where we're seeing issues.
Exactly, exactly. In small rural communities, we typically see less crime, less violence, fewer issues between the police and the public. The issues that we are seeing today are in oftentimes being seen in communities like New York City, Baltimore, Los Angeles, Cleveland, communities that have a long history of policing, communities that have fairly large police agencies, large number of officers, and these are the same agencies that are less likely to consolidate with other agencies because they're already at scale.
So how does training play into this, you think? Because one of the arguments I think a lot of people would make about decentralized police departments is that it means that officers are trained very differently in lots of different ways, and some may have, you know, de-escalation training and some may not.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I don't understand where some of these arguments are taking place, given where some of these problems have taken place. In the Baltimores, the New York, the Cleveland, the LAs, who are these agencies? How is consolidating with a surrounding police agency going to help address that issue that they had? How is New York City consolidating with perhaps some other local police agency going to deal with how the police dealt with an individual selling Lucy's mm-hmm. on the sidewalk? The larger police agencies have typically budgets that are the most likely to support training. Smaller agencies typically have less money to afford training. So the mm-hmm. the areas where we're seeing the most issues at the current moment are the same areas where they have the greatest availability of training. Now, with that said, over the past 8 or so years, we've seen massive cuts in training among police officers due to financial problems of communities, and those have hit all sorts of different police departments, and in large agencies in particular, training budgets are typically the first to be cut, and the training can go a long way towards addressing problems between a police department and the community.
That was the show's Lauren Gilger.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, today, I'm Mark Brody. For California prison inmate Roberta Blake, a trip across the country to a jail in Alabama for just a moment seemed like a break from prison life.
When I stepped out of the Ventura jail facility and I looked at the van, I was expecting a bus. And I seen the van, I'm like, where are the restrooms?
Where are the restrooms or windows or seats that recline if we drive all night? Where, above all, were the prison staff uniforms? Roberta was in the custody of a private contractor with the job of transporting prisoners from one facility to another to extradition hearings across the country and back. She's being transported by PTS, the largest contractor by far for the massive prison population in the United States. If business is booming for PTS, Roberta said she couldn't tell that from inside her van.
It was pitch black. I had no clue who was behind me, next to me. I couldn't see anything. And the heat had already started to get to me. And I realized I'm going to be in this van. After I got in is when he said, it's going to be 10 days before we get to Kentucky to continue on to Alabama. And after an hour, I was like, there's no way I can make it 10 days like this. I was handcuffed, shackled together in this small section. I couldn't move, I couldn't turn, I couldn't sleep. And he informed us that every 3 days they were required to stop at a jail and house us every 3 days.
Even though she was out of jail, Roberta Blake was in a mobile dungeon. She could barely keep track of the time of day, the dates of the month, of the week. From unheated windowless van to unheated windowless holding facility, herded by the guards.
They were mean. They didn't care whether we had air conditioning. They didn't care whether we were thirsty. They didn't care if we had to go to the bathroom. If we spoke too loud, they would slam on their brakes and we would get jolted forward. We weren't seatbelted in or anything.
Roberta spent all told 2 weeks in this cramped, sensory-deprived environment. And one more thing. She was surrounded by male prisoners the whole time who were supposed to be segregated, but even that was a joke. A restraint was broken.
They were flirting, derogatory remarks, I mean, very vulgar, and made me very uncomfortable. However, after speaking with them and everybody realizing we're having to deal with this together, we kind of just came together and encouraged each other to get us through to the next stop.
These inmates had to come together, Roberta said, because of moments like these, degrading bathroom breaks with a paper cup in a moving van.
There I am, handcuffed and shackled. They wouldn't undo a cuff. They wouldn't anything. The van is moving. And I honestly had trouble pulling down my pants. And the guy next to me, granted, I'm supposed to be segregated. I'm in the segregation cage. However, they don't put a lock on it. So it was the other inmates were able to open and close it free will. And we had opened it and he pulled my pants down for me. I don't know him from Adam. He pulled my pants down for me as I peed in the cup, then held my cup as I wiped with napkins and gave me my cup back. And kind of the big joke was, don't drop the cup, as he was pulling my pants back up for me. Later, I find out one of the inmates in there was in there for rape.
Roberta's testimony is part of an investigation by the Marshall Project, which confirmed her story. Roberta was eventually convicted of a misdemeanor in Alabama for returning a rental car late, 3 weeks in jail, then back to California on a Greyhound bus. Eli Hager is a reporter for the Marshall Project who spoke with dozens of inmates and guards who had spent time on these private contractor vans.
We're talking about largely 15-passenger vans. Prisoners are crammed in there, and they sit upright for days on end with no way to lie down to sleep. They're shackled at the wrists, waist, and ankles. There aren't bathrooms on board. They stop infrequently for bathrooms and food. So those are kind of the general conditions of the vans as they cross state lines.
Is there any regulation for how they're to be treated or how the vans are to be broken in terms of rests for drivers, rests for inmates?
On those aspects of the industry, no, there is not a regulation. There is one law that's supposed to regulate the industry through some broad strokes, but that law is focused on preventing escape. So it says things like if a prisoner escapes, these companies have to notify local law enforcement right away. They have to dress the inmates in brightly colored clothing, some things like that to prevent escapes. But that law has only been enforced one time in the 16 years that it existed.
Now, the idea that a prisoner is not going to have like the wildest time of their life on a journey from one end of the country to the other, it's not going to find a whole lot of sympathy to some people who are listening. What do you say here about these conditions and how they don't meet a test that you think is appropriate and relevant?
Well, I would say a number of things. First of all, it's important to know that a number of the people on these vans have not yet been convicted of any crime,
right?
Because they're being brought to face charges. So these are people that are not convicted, although they are sitting on the van next to convicted murderers and convicted rapists, and they're all mixed together, and there's no organization by charge. So I think that's an important point that a lot of people understand. And I also think that there are more humane ways to do this. The business model is such that these van companies are driven to pack the vans with as many people as possible since they're paid per prisoner. And they're also incentivized to drive at all hours through the night for days on end because they're paid by the mile by the jurisdictions.
And these individuals who haven't been convicted of a crime are not in the custody of the state. They're in the custody of a private company.
They're in the custody of a private company, correct. And that raises a lot of jurisdictional questions. If there needs to be an investigation of an incident on one of the vans or accountability after the fact, there's a lot of finger pointing because Alabama will say, well, that was California's prisoner. And California will say, well, that was Alabama's prisoner. And they're crossing state lines. So it's in this kind of black hole of oversight and accountability.
How unusual is this story in your investigation?
It's actually not as unusual as it sounds. We spoke to a lot of people who had been on these vans, and we spoke to even more guards of these vans who acknowledged that things that Roberta had to do, such as urinating in cups and bottles in front of the other prisoners, very common from what we heard from talking to over 50 guards, and other things like the terrible heat and no ventilation or air conditioning, very common from what we heard by speaking to insiders, and even the conditions between men and women on the same van, something that we heard repeatedly from people we spoke with.
Eli Hager is a reporter for the Marshall Project. As for Roberta Blake, after her experience with PTS, she would probably take a stationary prison any day of the week, but mostly she never thought a Greyhound bus trip home would feel so good.
And that's John Hockenberry with our partners at The Takeaway. More women than men are stricken with Alzheimer's disease. It's not simply because women live longer than men, living 4.5 years longer on average. Research is looking into the genetic factors and whether hormonal milestones such as puberty, pregnancy, and the onset of menopause are triggers. From the Arizona Science Desk, Sarah Hammond reports for KJZZ.
The University of Arizona has made brain research one of its focus areas. It's drawing from expertise in science, engineering and informatics, the science of information. Neuroscientist Roberta Diaz-Brinton leads the U of A's new Center for Innovation in Brain Science. Brinton received her undergraduate and graduate degrees in Tucson, and she researches Alzheimer's disease, the aging female brain, and develops therapies that can regenerate the brain. The Brain Science Center will be a collaborative effort of experts in a variety of disciplines from across the state.
We know that Arizona has a large aging population. Our center will be focusing on neurodegenerative diseases of aging. So our focus will really start with what is that aging process that then puts people at risk for development of a neurodegenerative disease.
Brinton says her approach to studying brain diseases is to start with the patient and end in the laboratory, a reversal of the traditional bench-to-bedside methodology. Brinton focuses on women who are affected the most by Alzheimer's disease. Her theory is that puberty, pregnancy, and the time around menopause are reproductive transitions that can affect neural circuits in the brain.
When we think about reproduction, we typically think about reproductive organs. But it's the brain that's controlling reproduction.
The brain controls most everything else in the human body, too, and it needs energy for all that, making it a good starting point for Alzheimer's research.
The brain is the most energetically demanding organ of the body. It weighs 2% of the body weight and uses 20% of the body's fuel glucose.
Our brain needs that glucose as we listen, learn, and search for information we have already acquired.
So it's these very energetically demanding functions of the brain that become first evident in Alzheimer's disease.
Between its onset and full menopause, there is a decline in the brain's glucose metabolism. Alzheimer's onset is about 20 years before it is diagnosed, and diagnosis occurs, on average, around age 72. Brinton says that means onset likely coincides with the beginning of menopause.
11% of the people over the age of 65 are predicted to develop Alzheimer's disease. And it is our hypothesis that we can detect the individuals who are at risk for developing Alzheimer's disease by studying their glucose metabolism, both in the body as well as in the brain.
Although there is no cure for neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis, Brinton says she is hopeful.
Within the next, 5 to 10 years, we should be able to really look at cure. We're going to be most successful and have rapid kind of advances and innovations around the prevention space and around the delay space. The curing space is going to be a tougher challenge, but it's a challenge I think we have the potential to overcome.
Cures and better treatments for Alzheimer's will take the work of scientists in everything from genetics to diseases. That's the idea behind the Arizona Alzheimer's Consortium, which scientists formed in 1998 and fosters collaboration among institutions throughout the state. The consortium produces dozens of studies each year that have examined the molecular mechanisms, risk factors, and physiological processes behind what many believe could be a scourge on the oldest and most vulnerable seniors. I'm Sarah Hammond in Tucson.
3D printing has been used to make everything from knives to jewelry to sculpture to cars, and now we can add facial implants to that list. Dr. Pablo Pritchard, Chief of Plastic Surgery at Honor Health Lincoln, has been using these implants, and he joins me with more on this. And Pablo, so you brought some show and tell with you, and one item kind of looks like a plastic skull, the other a side of a skull. Where is medicine in terms of the use of these 3D printed implants and the effectiveness of this technology in surgery?
The use of this technology at this point is replacing bone that's lost, mostly if it's lost in a crush injury where the bone is pulverized and cannot be put back together.
So that would have to be a fairly traumatic injury, I would think, in many cases.
Sure. Such as an auto versus pedestrian accident where the face of the person gets hit by the car and that explosive type of energy obliterates the bone.
How long have we been able to do this? It's only a couple of years since the FDA approved it, right?
Sure, yeah, only for the last 2 years or so.
And has this been widely used by physicians and surgeons?
Actually, I have some numbers on that. There are different types of implants, and some are much simpler than others. So that's why I brought these little audiovisuals here. The one that you see here is a very simple curvature of a skull. And this
is probably about the size of a little bit bigger than the palm of your hand.
Yes, yes. And you can imagine basically the side of somebody's head. So kind of a curve, not a very intricate structure. But these type of implants are used especially when a victim has a bad head trauma and the brain is expanding. The bone has to be removed or the bone has been pulverized and the brain is allowed to expand. Now there's a big hole in the side of the head and we need to protect the brain with a nice structural implant.
Are surgeons reluctant to use this kind of thing? I mean, are there a lot of early adopters of this kind of technology?
Well, about 4,000 of these type of procedures were done in about the last year or so. And so that's, you know, taken on pretty widely at this point.
What was it about this technology? What did you see in it that led you to think, yeah, this could really work and it seems like it's probably safe?
Well, the things that we used to do before this technology were to take metal titanium sheets and try to bend them and kind of sculpt a face out of this. Also using bony cement that could be kind of sculpted by hand at the time of surgery. The problem with those techniques are the metal sheet, it's not very strong. It sounds like a titanium sheet would be very strong, but it's also very thin. And so creating that sheet, I've seen where the body contracts around that sheet and actually bends the metal back down. And so we had problems with that. As far as the bony cement that we would kind of mix right on hand in the operative room and then implant and just kind of sculpt to the contours of the face, you really only have about 2 minutes to sculpt before that implant dries and sets. And so that's not a lot of time to be perfect. And what attracted me to this was that you could literally take a CAT scan of the face and then project a mirror image of the opposite side and then print a three-dimensional implant that's very, very, very strong, much stronger even than bone, and implant that, and now you've got a perfect match with the opposite side.
Obviously, since we're still sort of in the early days of this technology, we don't really know how patients will do with this in the long term, but it sounds like you're fairly confident that there will be better outcomes for patients with this than with what you were using before.
Sure. I think it's better cosmetically as well as better structurally because that implant is, like I said, much stronger than that metal sheeting that we used to put.
What is the cost consideration for this kind of technology as opposed to what you had been doing?
Certainly the cost is more expensive. The cost of these implants can range from $10,000 to $15,000. So it's considerably more than a titanium sheet, which, you know, probably is $1,000 or so, and, you know, with all the screws and that sort of thing. So it's considerably more. But again, long term, this is a really, really good outcome for the patient.
Dr. Pablo Pritchard is Chief of Plastic Surgery at Honor Health Lincoln.
The Netherlands is often cited as the country most likely to follow the UK and vote on leaving the EU. The far-right politician Geert Wilders says an in-out referendum will be a central plank of the campaign by his Freedom Party in elections in March. But in the meantime, instead of concerning themselves with talk of so-called contagion, the Dutch have been working out ways to capitalize on the departure of their closest political and economic ally. The BBC's Anna Hulligan reports.
The headlines require little translation.
Europa is in shock na de keuze van de Britten.
That shock swiftly gave way to the question, could the Netherlands be next? Dutch Eurosceptics swooped. There is a shared concern about European immigration and Brussels bureaucracy here. And yet, Nexit is by no means inevitable.
Our interests in the internal market are even larger than the UK's interests.
Jeroen Dijsselbloem is the Dutch finance minister.
About 80% of our export goes to the European partners. Certainly here in the parliament there's hardly any support. A very strong majority of the Dutch still feel that we should be inside the EU, reform it, make it better. We would have liked to have done it with the British. There's also very little support among our people, among the electorate. Very few people have the appetite to have this kind of referendum.
The latest polls suggest 53% of voters are opposed to the idea of an in-out referendum. Why?
We don't see the EU as a threat, as a big imperial monster. We see it as something you can negotiate with. My name is Hans Stekete. I'm an editor at NRC Handelsblad.
Do you think that Brexit has actually made Nexit less likely?
I think so. My gut feeling says that people will say, oh, well, if this is what happens after Brexit vote, we should definitely think twice.
The fallout from Brexit has sent ripples of apprehension across the North Sea. In a cozy cafe on the cobbled banks of one of Amsterdam's canals, the prominent Eurosceptic campaigner Thierry Baudet told me he believes the European politicians are deliberately playing hardball in an attempt to prevent other countries from following the UK out of the EU.
I'm not sure that, as we say in Dutch, the soup will be eaten as hot as it's being served. So, do they really think that this is the way to keep others in? By scaring and fighting Britain? That will backfire sooner or later. It's not a position that is sustainable in the long run.
With the UK's future inside the single market still uncertain, pragmatic politicians are seizing on the potential capital flight to lure banks and businesses across the channel. An article in the New York Times puts Amsterdam ahead of Dublin, Frankfurt and Paris as the city most likely to succeed London as the global financial capital.
We feel very close to the city of London, and at the same time, we're competitors. My name is Kajsa Ollongren. I'm a deputy mayor of the city of Amsterdam.
We're in your office looking out over the beautiful city of Amsterdam, but it's small, 830,000 residents. Can you really compete? Can Amsterdam really compete with the bright lights of London?
If you are in Amsterdam, then Europe is your market. This also is a question for companies from Asia or companies from the United States who want to come to Europe. That is what is important for companies right now, to have access to the internal market of the European Union. It's a sort of a world city in a pocket size, and we try as much as possible to be ready also in the future.
The only potential deterrent cited was the Dutch cap on bankers' bonuses. At his weekly press conference, the Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, moved to reassure the banking industry. Those caps on bankers' bonuses, he says, are flexible for foreigners. And in the meantime, there are many here who want the Brits to know they still have friends on the continent.
That's the BBC's Anna Holligan in Amsterdam. Phoenix is nearly a top 10 tech talent market, according to the commercial real estate firm CBRE. The company recently released its tech talent report, which looked at 50 markets across the U.S. and Canada. Phoenix comes in at number 11, although it also ranked near the top in the brain drain category. With me to talk about the results is Lexi Russell, a senior research analyst for CBRE. And Lexi, what were you trying to find out with this report?
Well, as a commercial real estate firm, we are often asked by clients to help them determine which markets they should be considering when they're expanding or relocating or remaining in a location for recruitment or talent purposes. A lot of times these clients are seeking to capitalize in an area where the tech talent labor segment of the population is growing. And we wanted to help them figure out where they could be looking.
How exactly did you try to analyze each individual market?
So that's where we created the score. Basically, the score is a combination of 13 metrics that we used to rank the comparative advantage of these 50 tech markets across the U.S. and Canada, including tech talent, the growth and concentration and cost of talent, the knowledgeable, highly skilled individuals in the market, so tech degree completion rates and R&D funding by colleges and universities in each market, as well as commercial market real estate fundamentals and the residential market, apartment rents and growth and the outlook of that. So we combined 13 different numbers to create a ranking. So the way we ranked them was more of a decathlon ranking. If one market was far ahead of the others, you can see it in the score. So when you compare the number one and number two markets of San Francisco and Washington, D.C. San Francisco came in at about 84 points, while the number two of Washington, D.C. was at 67 points.
So Phoenix came in at number 11. How far behind number 10 was it? How far behind some of the other top 10 markets was it?
So Phoenix, in at number 11, had a score of 58. And Baltimore, number 10, had a score of 58.19. So it's very close.
Well, did Phoenix's strengths play more to, as you say, the cost of living, sort of the cost of housing, and less to the availability and the presence of a tech sector here?
Actually, the Phoenix tech sector is very strong. There are more than 86,000 tech talent workers, and this is across all industries, not just tech companies. We looked at all these tech occupations. So the tech talent labor market in Phoenix is, I think, 13th out of the top 50. And they've grown 58% in the last 10 years. That's an addition of about 32,000 tech talent workers.
The report also found that Phoenix was one of the top markets for what's called brain drain, which is the tech workers leaving the area. Does that indicate that this market has some work to do to become more sustainable, to keep those folks here?
So the brain drain list that you're referring to compares tech degree completions with new tech jobs. And just because they're a brain drain, that means they're producing a lot more tech degrees than jobs. They're still producing a lot of jobs. They added 32,000 new tech workers, but they added more people with these highly skilled laborers that may have moved away. We think of it as a positive. We think that producing the number of highly skilled workers is a great positive. It's a great draw.
Lexi Russell is a senior research analyst with CBRE in San Francisco. We are talking about the firm's annual scoring tech talent report. Lexi, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Post-War Architecture Task Force of Greater Phoenix has compiled a new list of the top 25 mid-century buildings that are eligible for protection but do not have it. To qualify, buildings have to still be standing and not have been altered too far. They have had to have been in the mid-century Marvels book. They have to be eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. And in the eyes of the task force, they have to be missed if they were gone. The 25 include banks, offices, a dry cleaner, and a bowling alley. Allison King with ModernPhoenix.net is a member of the task force. I met her at one of the buildings on the list, the Phoenix Financial Center, in what is now the offices of the Design Firm Shapley Bullfinch, and asked her about the list.
We're really concerned about the state of commercial architecture here in Phoenix and the rate of development that's happening with our mid-century buildings. And so the Post-War Architecture Task Force took a look at the Mid-Century Marvels book, which was written by Don Ryden many years ago, and started to realize that many of those buildings no longer existed. And so about 4 years ago, we put together our first top 25 list. And it included some of the greatest hits. We have amazing mid-century banks in the city, so it included lots of the banks. And what we found is over the years, since we've gotten out of the recession and development is starting up again, that we have new priorities and new concerns. First among them is the Stewart Motor Company building downtown, which many people know as Circles Records, and the development circle on Central that's happening there.
Phoenix, obviously, as you said, has quite a history of mid-century buildings, especially commercial buildings, bank buildings, and other types of commercial buildings. What is the state now in terms of trying to preserve them or convert them into some other use?
Well, we are seeing a lot of adaptive reuse of the mid-century buildings here in town, especially for use in restaurants and hospitality. Any drive up and down 7th Street in Camelback area, you can see a lot of activity going there. But we're not seeing a lot of pure preservation like we see here at the Phoenix Financial Center, or restoration, where it's taking it back to its original state or close to its original state. So part of the reason why we made the top 25 list was to bring attention to the property owners and to let them know that we Phoenicians really love the city that we live in and we love the design and that it's really worth preserving, because without that protection, anything could happen. And Circles is a great example.
So are you concerned that any of those buildings could either meet a wrecking ball or be changed so much that they lose what they have from the mid-century modern design?
Absolutely, and especially in the post-recession era, the development is happening so quickly and is so hard to regulate. And, development along the light rail has made real estate quite valuable along that strip. And so, I think we have to be very vigilant and very proactive rather than reactive, and that's part of why we developed the top 25 list.
So what kind of protection would you like to see these buildings get?
I would love nothing more than to see them on the National Register of Historic Places and also on the City Register, because while the National Register of Historic Places sounds very exciting, it's purely really honorific, and so you really only get those city level protections if you get on the City Register.
How optimistic are you that some or all of these buildings will end up on that list?
Well, I have a long view. I know it's not going to happen overnight. I know this all starts with conversations, and so I know many of the property owners on this list and will occasionally reach out to them and remind them that we're thinking about them, and that especially now in the post-recession era, that we really need to start thinking about the city that we would like to curate and have still standing 50 years from now. Because a lot of people say, here in Phoenix, we don't have a lot of old 100-year-old buildings or 200-year-old buildings, but there's a great saying in the preservation community that if you don't save your 50-year-old buildings, you're not going to have any 100-year-old buildings left.
Well, as you said, I mean, Phoenix has this reputation for not having a lot of older buildings, but it seems like it is sort of getting this reputation for having a stock of mid-century modern buildings. I mean, does Phoenix sort of have a reputation for this period of architecture?
Absolutely. And in fact, in the national press, we're often compared to Palm Springs in terms of the volume and the artistry and the level of mid-century desert modern design that we have here.
To what do you attribute specifically this city's fascination with this time period?
You know, that's a really good question, and I've had some time to think about that on summer vacation, because I just took a trip to Denver in Colorado and drove through the Rockies, and I was flabbergasted at how much of their Western architecture from the turn of the century they had actually managed to preserve. And we really don't have a lot of that here in Phoenix. And I think that part of why we're so fascinated, to get to your question about mid-century architecture here in Phoenix, is there is so much of it left, and it doesn't hide. It really stands out in contrast to what was built later in the 1970s and 1980s. And it's very exuberant. It's very uplifting. People feel good when they see it. People feel good when they're in it. And that's part of why I'm in this business, is I really like to see the look on people's faces when they experience these buildings for the first time.
Allison King with ModernPhoenix.net is a member of the Postwar Architecture Task Force of Greater Phoenix. We were talking about the panel's list of the top 25 eligible but unprotected mid-century marvels. The list got us thinking, why are we so fascinated by this time in history? Is it all just about a certain TV show? To find out if the mid-century modern craze is more than just Mad Men related, I'm joined by Amanda Dameron, editor-in-chief of Dwell Magazine. And Amanda, do you think the popularity mid-century modern design and architecture is enjoying now is a fad, or do you think it actually has staying power?
You know, honestly, I feel as though that this is just a truism, culturally speaking. I think that, again, with fashion and design in this sense of being representative of an aesthetic sensibility and a popular culture's aesthetic sensibility, things do come back and ebb and flow. And I think that we see this in furniture and interiors and the clothes that we wear. But another part of that is I think that with each new era, it's a reinterpretation, and the calling back is comforting.
How much of this do you think we can trace back to Mad Men?
That's a great question. I think quite a bit. Certainly. I think with any really popular television show just informs the culture's imagination as a whole, the way that Mad Men did, or any other really, really popular television show or widely consumed piece of content, it tremendously affects what people are interested in, and also what products are developed in a more mass consumer level for people to buy. So I would say that Mad Men was tremendously effective in awakening people's appreciation for mid-century modernism, certainly.
Is there something different about this era, though? Because, for example, like Downton Abbey is pretty popular, but you don't see a lot of people walking around wearing corsets.
Well, I would. I think that there's subcultures for everything. Certainly, it gets to a point where it transcends just a subculture, and it's more of a mass consumer level. And I'd agree that mid-century modernism is at that place. And I think there's something inherent to, because I don't think you're off base. I do think there's something inherent to the look and the feel of that design sensibility that is very accessible, and it's organic looking, and it's comfortable, and it wears well. So there's something to be said for that.
Do you think that our interest in this era now is just about the way things looked? I mean, is there anything about sort of how life was at that time or what society was like at the time that people are interested in maybe learning about or trying to recreate in some way?
Well, I think that certainly it must be said that that era in our history was a time of great optimism. And I think that that is always a comforting place to return to.
Well, for how long do you think that this trend will continue? I mean, at what point will we stop wearing skinny ties and stop having sort of these clean lines on all of our furniture and our design?
Well, I wish I could say that I have a crystal ball and I know how long these trends ebb and flow. I think that it's hard to define a certain shelf life to trends in any case. But I do think that there's so much attached to the era that is so livable, is so accessible, and certainly with the way our culture has changed and the way that we view imagery and get inspiration and ideas, it is certainly locked into place, mid-century modernism and that appreciation for now.
Amanda Dameron is the editor-in-chief of Dwell Magazine. Amanda, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Pokemon Go. That's probably either your newest obsession or your two least favorite words. The GPS-based mobile game was released less than a week ago, but is already a cultural phenomenon. It's been downloaded millions of times and brought Nintendo, which owns a stake in the Pokemon franchise, billions of dollars. So KJZZ's Stina Sieg went in search of Pokemon and the game's impact on the Valley.
Problem is, I don't know anything about Pokemon Go, and I don't have the storage left on my phone to download it. So I hopped in the car with a Pokemon ambassador.
Got him.
I got him. Okay, just letting you know.
Sky Shout is my coworker and a mom who's been driving around town with her family in search of Pokemon, who are virtual creatures you can digitally capture and train. It's a good thing for the kids, she says, except
they don't know anything about directions or where anything is. So they'll just say, ah, and they'll be like, what do you want me to do? It's,
They would probably be totally overwhelmed at our first stop, the Phoenix Zoo, with a Pokemon population of more than 30.
It's sort of a hotbed, or a treasure trove of Pokemon here.
That zoo spokeswoman, Carrie Bauman, who downloaded the game shortly after it was released.
I may have been a little enthusiastic about it.
Which is good, because she was told to scour the zoo to make sure all the Pokemon were in safe spots. Zoos in other cities have reported Pokemon in off-limit areas.
At that point, I was kind of floored that I was asked to play the game at work at the zoo. Doesn't get any better than that.
Not only did Bauman find a bunch of safely accessible Pokemon, but she met many fellow players. They're easy to spot, she says, looking down intently at their phones and making quick, occasional swiping motions with their finger. At our second stop, a Phoenix gas station, clerk Sam Reyes says he's been seeing this for days.
Today, three people.
Reyes says it's strange to see people looking around the station store and circling the gas pumps, phone in hand, as if they've lost something, especially since they all seem to be in their 20s and 30s.
It's weird. You're seeing adults, you know, playing. It's like a kid's game, you know?
He's not the only one flummoxed by this cultural phenomenon. A spokesman for an international aerospace company had never heard of the game until something called a Poke Spot was placed on one of the company's buildings in North Phoenix. It seems no one's tried to jump the property's fence yet, but the company beefed up its security just in case. Phoenix Police Lieutenant Paul Taylor says he had to look up Pokemon Go on Wikipedia just so he could handle the dozen or so media requests he's gotten so far.
Yeah, if you had told me 10 years ago that you would need to come talk to the police department about a video game, I would have thought you were funny. But those are the times in which we live now.
Taylor, who hasn't been hooked on video games since the Atari era, says reporters like me have been asking constantly about possible crimes or safety issues associated with Pokemon Go. Turns out there have been reports of Pokemon-related misdeeds across the country, and there are big concerns about privacy because of how much personal data the game collects. But Taylor says it's too soon to know how much nefarious activity Pokemon Go has generated in Phoenix. Valley police departments have issued a reminder to people not to trespass, and Taylor says just be aware, especially when you're playing the game outside.
If you don't feel safe there, follow that instinct and always remember that a video game is not worth your health and safety and your personal property.
So follow that instinct instead of following a Pokemon?
Very well succinctly put, yes ma'am.
And if your instinct takes you to the Phoenix Zoo, you're in luck. Starting this weekend, the place will be open an hour early to accommodate Pokemon Go players and the general public. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.